Hi everybody. Nice to be back. Nice to see you all. Thanks to Kathy for her great talk last week on chapters 16 and 17 of the Dhammapada. She managed in her usual way to sort of pierce through the surface of the text and give us a good Zen, good bracing Zen understanding of it. I appreciated that. I'm going to go on with the next chapters, but before I do that, I would like to take a moment, if you're willing, to sadly acknowledge the passing in the last week or so of two very dear and important Sangha members. Many of you knew Kathleen Martin. Maybe you did not know that she passed away last week after her very long illness. I first met Kathleen a long time ago when I used to give university classes. I gave a class at UC Berkeley Extension, and Kathleen and Eva came to that class and continued to practice with us for decades. Eva, as you know, is one of our lay teachers now. She's here tonight, I think. Kathleen's Dharma name is Shindo Ninshin, True Earth, Patient Faith. And that was Kathleen, a very down-to-earth person from Michigan, with a great faith in Dharma and a great faith in life. And sadly, for a number of years now, she's been suffering from Lewy body syndrome, which is really a difficult disease. And that's why maybe some of you don't know her, because we haven't seen much of her in recent years. But I'm really grateful that Sue and Christopher kept track of her throughout all this time, right up until the end. Kathleen was such a shy, sweet, and really funny person. And we really love her a lot, and we truly miss her. The other person may not be known to most of you. She was from our Mountain Rain community up in Vancouver, British Columbia. She was also a member of our Jewish meditation community up there. And so I saw her many times on all my trips up there, which used to be quite frequent over the years, less now. She was a physician, beloved by many, many people, and she was a passionate environmentalist and activist. She had had a very rough childhood. She was the child of Holocaust survivors, which is always tough. But in addition to that, when she was a young girl, she was born and raised as a young girl in Hungary, and she had to escape Hungary by going underground when the communists cracked down on Hungary, which is something that only the very oldest of us will remember. In the early to mid 1950s, that happened, and she sort of s escaped Hungary by the skin of her teeth. Marianne also had a really terrible illness, ALS, that took her body away from her bit by bit by bit over an actually rather short period of time. She had a very sad and difficult passage, and she passed last Friday. So, if you will, can we take just a few breaths to practice sending and receiving for Kathleen and Marianne as they travel through the in-between realms? Thank you. Okay, so tonight we're going to go on with reading Dhammapada. I hope you're enjoying this. It's nice to have a reading project, right? Read through something carefully. I like doing that. I've always got reading projects going. This is 18 and 19 tonight. Gill's title for chapter 18 is corruption. A word that is sadly much used at the present moment. But another translation is, which probably is, maybe makes more sense to us, is impurity. Impurity. Can we, somebody's not muted who's making lots of noise with their, can we do that? Mute someone? Yeah, great. Thanks, Lainey. So impurity, I think, is a little bit of a better title. It's sort of what it means, impurity, rather than corruption as we would understand it in social terms. So here's the opening stanzas. You are now like a yellowed leaf. Yama's henchmen, Yama is the Lord of Death. Yama's henchmen are standing by. You stand at the door of death with no provisions for the journey. Make an island for yourself. Be quick in making effort. Be wise, unblemished, with corruption removed. You'll enter the divine realm of the noble ones. You are now at the end of life. You're headed for Yama's presence with no resting place along the way, no provisions for the journey. Make an island for yourself. Be quick in making effort. Be wise, unblemished, with impurity removed. You'll experience birth and old age no more. So these opening verses are meant to be a little chilling. We're imagining that we are at the very end of our lives. We're like a dried yellow leaf, maybe the last one on the tree, just about to fall off. And Yama, the Lord of Death, is waiting for us down below. And maybe it's scary. And maybe we feel like, oh no, I'm not ready for this. I have the feeling, which is as much a feeling as a hope, that that was not true for Kathleen and Marianne, who had had these terrible illnesses that maybe had the good side of preparing them for the end. Plus, they both had such good hearts. So I hope that they were ready. I think that they were. But in this verse, we imagine that we're not ready. And that now, at the very end, we better get ready right away. And we can do that. We can get ready because we've practiced a long time. And so it's possible for us. We can slough off the remaining afflictions, the remaining fears and regrets, insecurities, impurities. And we can join the Buddhas in entering Nirvana without any more restless need to go on struggling. As Gill, many of the other translators translate, make an island for yourself. When we hear that, an island sounds like a kind of lonely thing. And it reminds us of John Donne's great poem, no man, no person is an island entire unto themselves. So island sounds isolated and lonely, though in the poem, Dunn's meaning is that every person matters. But here, island is meant not in the sense of apart from others, solitary, but all-inclusive, an island in the great stream, beautiful and self-sufficient. It's the same word that the Buddha used at the end of his life when he said to his disciples, be islands unto yourself, meaning, don't worry that I'm leaving. You have everything you need, you'll be fine. And I'm sure that this verse uses that same word so that we can recall the Buddha's last words. But probably you've heard those words not translated as be islands unto yourselves, but be lamps unto yourselves, guiding yourself on your own way. You have what you need to guide yourself. And the word dipa actually means both, oddly, it seems hard to imagine, but apparently the word dipa does mean both light and island. Either way, it suggests both the sense that we all contain everything we need and that each one of us is luminous. The Buddha once said, the mind of each person is luminous. So we cannot be alone because there is no aloneness that doesn't include everything. So there's no one that could be alone. They say, you know, that when we die alone. Nobody can die with us. Even if, God forbid, as has happened in the past, we would die in a room full of people all dying with us, even so, every one of us would be dying alone. And yet, nobody dies alone. We always die with everyone and everything. And when a person dies, the whole universe dies with them. And the poem of Donne actually ends with the lines that I'm sure you know, "Don't ask for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee." So every death is ours. Now the next verse, as a smith does with silver, the wise person gradually, bit by bit, moment by moment, removes impurities from herself. Though the previous verse kind of is meant to kick us in gear with taking care of the impurities within ourselves, we don't wait until the end to do that. That would be a little bit too much of a big job. Actually, we do it the whole time, all the time, our whole life through. We practice purification our whole life through, little by little, as a silversmith purifies and shines a piece of silver. We're purifying and shining up, polishing up our hearts, our minds, our character, our conduct. As rust corrupts the very iron that formed it, so transgressions lead their doer to states of woe. So here, the image of iron rust, sort of iron rusting, sort of goes in the opposite direction. Purify, silver is already pretty good, and so we purify it and make it better. But here we see that we can be corroded by our impurities, by our afflictive emotions, our bad conduct, our attachment, our self-clinging. We can be corroded by them just the same way that iron naturally is corroded by rust. But when we practice taking care of our conduct of body, speech, and mind, we can prevent that from taking place. Yes, we know our bodies might break down over time as we get older and older and older, but our spirit can remain strong and shiny and silver. Oral teachings become corrupted when not recited. Homes are corrupted by inactivity. Sloth corrupts physical beauty. Negligence corrupts a guardian. Bad conduct is corrupted in a person. Bad conduct is corruption in a person. Stinginess is corruption in a giver. Evil traits corrupt people in both this world and the next. But more corruption than all of these is ignorance, the greatest corruption. Having abandoned this corruption, monks remain free of all impurities. So these verses are giving us in a kind of list, different ways that impurity, neither one of these words is so grating, purity or corruption, neither one of them captures what the Buddha is trying to say here. It's a kind of moral decay that happens to us when we don't pay attention to our lives. That's what he's really means here. So these are the different ways that kinds of conduct that will cause a kind of moral corruption or moral decay to invade our spirit. Not paying attention, being negligent, doing bad stuff, being stingy, and so on. But the root of all of these kinds of impurity or corruption, as the last verse tells us, is ignorance. And that's why always in Dharma practice, it is necessary but not sufficient to take care of our conduct. That's necessary, but it is not enough. To really be free of impurity, you have to understand the root of impurity, which is ignorance. Not knowing who you really are, not knowing the world as it really is, not understanding the fundamental realities of our human existence. So many of the Buddhist teachings, all of which are meant to be understood from the inside, not as ideas or thoughts or concepts, but as inside understandings, teachings like emptiness, like the mind-only teachings, like the teachings on Buddha nature. They're all different ways to show us the way things really are, so as to dispel our ignorance. And that's the only way that ultimately we can be free of attachment and impurity. Easy is life for someone without conscience. Bold as a crow. Obtrusive, deceitful, reckless, and corrupt. Difficult is life for someone with conscience, always searching for what's pure, discerning, sincere, cautious, and clean living. So I usually say the exact opposite of this. I say that, and I think it's true, that it's actually much more difficult not to practice than it is to practice, because not practicing, you suffer a lot more. And that is a harder path, I think, in life than having some ease and happiness. But here it says the opposite of that. It's easier not to practice because when you don't practice, you can just, go ahead and do whatever you feel like doing whatever comes naturally. If you want to be selfish, as most people are, self-centered, just go with that. Do what you want. If stuff happens that you don't like, run away from it, get rid of it if you can. Just be like everybody else in the world. It's much easier. And the image for this is a crow. There's lots of crows around here, so I'm familiar with crows. They're very bold, they're loud, they're reckless. They say they're reckless. I don't know if they're really reckless, but anyway, they say they're reckless. So then, by the logic of this verse, practicing is more difficult because practicing is to go against the grain. It's to go against what everybody does, what comes naturally. It's more difficult to pay attention to body, speech, and mind. It's more difficult to be kind, to be careful, to be honest. All these things might seem harder to do at first. And it does seem true, as many people discover with some degree of shock toward the beginning of their practice, that practicing is a lot harder than they thought it would be, because they thought, well, I need a little help. I'm coming to practice because I could do better than I'm doing, but basically I'm okay. I just need a little improvement. But then you start practicing and you start looking at your own heart and your own mind, and you say, oh my God, this is a lot worse than I thought it was. I knew I wasn't perfect, but boy, I did not know how much confusion and selfishness and violence and all that was inside of me. Ah, God, I agreed. That seemed like a foreign word, but yes, I'm totally greedy all the time, you know, and I'm so impatient. I'm so reckless all the time. I never knew it. So at first it seems like that, but then, you know, you go on for a while, and not that that improves that much necessarily, but you stop minding it. You know, you stop being shocked by it. You say, well, it's all right anyway. I think I'll just keep going anyway with practice. And somehow or other, all this stuff does calm down a bit. And you don't worry about, you know, how rotten you are. You think, well, you know, I'm just like everybody else. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. And anyway, when you're on an infinite journey, you're never that close to the end of it anyway. You know, no matter how far along you are or aren't, what's the difference? So you just keep going. So after a while, I think you look at it like that, and you don't mind so much. You know, it's sort of pretty normal. Whatever goes on, it's pretty normal. One digs up one's root here in this very world. If one kills, lies, steals, goes to another spouse, or gives oneself up to drink and intoxicants, good person, know this. Evil traits are reckless. Don't let greed and wrongdoing oppress you with long-term suffering. So this is the truth, you know. It's really dangerous not to practice. It's really dangerous to be reckless and heedless in your conduct. If your conduct of body, speech, and mind is careless, you're going to do a lot of harm to yourself and everyone else. And I think we all have seen this, you know, we look around the world and we've seen this in many other people, people in our lives who have kind of run themselves into the ground with their careless, bad conduct and hurt a lot of other people in the process. So breaking precepts is not just being a bad girl or a bad boy. And moral conduct is not something extra imposed from the outside by some authority. It's one of the deepest and most profound understandings in Dharma that we humans are simply built to do good and be good. And to do otherwise does violence to our human nature. And if you don't believe this, or maybe you believe the opposite, that human beings are basically nasty, violent, cruel, and of course there's lots of evidence you can find for that point of view. But if you believe like that, that's really terrible. You know, you don't want to think like that. Because if you think that way, what that means is you have no faith, no confidence, no respect for your own human self. And no respect, no confidence in, no trust in anyone else. And that is a terrible, terrible way to live. I think that is what being in hell must be like, right? Be like that. That's really bad. According to their faith, according to their satisfaction, people give. This being the case, if one is envious of the food and drink given to others, one does not attain samadhi, meditation, concentration, by day or by night. But by cutting out, uprooting, and discarding this envious state, one gains samadhi by day or by night. So this verse seems to be very specifically directed to monastics, telling them, don't be envious of the alms food that other people get, because sometimes it happens that way. You go begging, you know, and you have like, you know, a few little kind of crappy things in your bowl, and you look around to the next guy who went begging on another street, maybe a better looking monastic than you are, shiny, you know, so like some people can be. And they have a lot of great food in their bowl, so you're really mad at them and envious. That's what it specifically means, but I think actually that it's very applicable to the world that we live in now. And this is something I've thought about for a long, long time, or maybe 10 years or so, I've been thinking this thought. Envy and resentment, you know, are very close to one another, right? I envy you, and therefore I resent you. It's almost like one and the same thing. You know, I remember reading of a study that was very startling, but when you think about it, it's quite common sense. It said that if there are poor people and they live in a county surrounded by other poor counties, so everywhere they look, their people are poor like them, then people are don't mind that much being poor. However, when there's a poor county surrounded by much more wealthy counties, and maybe that county isn't even all that poor, but the counties all around it are much more wealthy, then the people in that less wealthy county are very resentful and very envious of the people around them. So this is an interesting thing because people say about our society in the last decades or so, it's one of the topics of conversation, although you don't hear it very much recently, but there was a lot of talk about how there was a great increase in inequality. And I'm sure that's true. I think we can demonstrate that it's true. But interestingly, I think the opposite is also true. There are actually more people, not only in this country, but all over the world, more people that are well off than there ever have been before. More wealthy people and more middle class people. Lots and lots of people who were in the past would have been living in a hard scrabble, poor situation have been lifted out of poverty. And many, many millions of people have entered the middle class that wouldn't have been able to enter it before. But paradoxically, this makes things worse because those who are not so well off feel worse off than ever and more resentful. And more apt to align themselves with leaders who express and act out of the resentment that they feel. So I've been, contemplating for about the last decade the power of this feeling of human resentment, the destructive power of it is truly awesome. And this is something that the Buddha understood very, very well. And it's that understanding that's, I think, pervades everything that the Buddha is saying in this chapter. The next verse. There's no fire like lust and no grasping like hate, no snare like delusion and no river like craving. Yeah, so that's what he's talking about. Lust, hate, delusion, craving. This is the power of resentment. And it becomes a fire. It burns up the world. It becomes like a flood that inundates us. Now he changes subjects a little bit, topics a little bit. There's no fire like lust. Sorry. It's easy. I just when I read that one. It's easy to see the faults of others, but hard to see one's own. One sifts out the faults of others like chaff, but conceals one's own as a cheat conceals a bad throw of the dice. If one focuses on others' faults and constantly takes offense, one's own toxins flourish and one is far from their destruction. So we've talked about this before, I think, recently, how important it is to de-emphasize paying attention to the faults of others, which are so easy to notice, and you can really get obsessed about them. Instead, pay more attention to your own conduct, because you really can't do much to change other people's behavior. And to expect that they will change or to require that they change is really a path of unhappiness. But you can, with practice and with patience, pay attention to your own conduct and little by little reduce its bad effects on you. The more you focus on others' faults, however severe they may be, the more upset you're going to get. And you might even get to the point where you're going to scheme about how you're going to straighten them out or even do them harm. And when you start thinking like that, you're going to be in bad shape. That's very bad for you. Think what a sad thing that is. In effect, what it means is you are living the other person's life. This other person that you really don't like and don't approve of, you're filling your head with that person's life. And neglecting your own. That's what's happening when you fill your mind with the other's faults and ignore your own life. And the last two paired verses of the chapter, no path exists in space, no contemplatives exist outside the Buddhist path. Gill interpolates those words. People are enamored with obsessive thoughts. Tathagatas are free of obsessive thinking. No path exists in space. No contemplatives exist outside. No created things are eternal. No agitation exists for Buddhas. So these first two lines that appear as the first two lines of both these stanzas, no path exists in space, no contemplatives exist outside. It's a little hard actually to know precisely what the Buddha meant here. I mean, Gill sort of, by interpolating the words, the Buddha's path, outside the Buddha's path, gives us a kind of interpretation. What he's saying is, well, you have to have a path. You can't get anywhere without a path. And the Buddha's path is the path that ends all impurity, the path of happiness. But remember, a week or several weeks ago, we read that the Buddha's path is pathless. Remember that? The Buddha flies free in the sky like a bird who knows where to go without a path. And that's a line that's often repeated in some places in Dogen. So I think that in my reading, the lines say something like, in space, there's no path. Space is clear of any path. And in the external world, there is no practitioner, because the practitioner is clear and free within the external world. The external world cannot obstruct the practitioner. So remember, this whole chapter is about impurity, and the impurity referred to is not the impurity of the external world, it's the impurity of the mind and the spirit. The Buddha is the one who understands and purifies the mind, and in doing this, the Buddha is free, and we can be free of the constraints and the pain and the sorrow that seem to be so endemic to this external world. Just as space is free and open, so the mind of the awakened one is free and open, even in this troubled and difficult world. I think that's something like what the verses mean. Ordinary people are troubled and limited by the world because the world captures their minds, fastens the mind to the world. But the Buddha, our Buddhas are free of thinking and agitation, not caught, in other words, by thinking or agitation. And in that way, they are free and open in a troubled world. Okay, chapter 19. The title is translated by Gill, The Just. Other translations say, The Righteous. But Tanisaro's translation is The Judge, which I kind of like, The Judge. Because you hear so many people talk about judgment. You know, we're very obsessed with the idea of judgment, self-judgment especially. Don't be judgmental, people will say. Oh, that was so judgmental. So it's very bad to be judgmental, it would appear. I don't know what people mean exactly by self-judgment, but definitely we're all striving to not have so much self-judgment. We're striving to be non-judgmental. So that's why I like it that provocatively this chapter is called The Judge. Because the truth is, there is no way not to judge. There is no way that you could not discriminate if you have a mind. The mind discriminates. And this is a good thing for practice, because to follow precepts and be a decent person, you have to know the difference between decency and non-decency. Otherwise, how are you going to choose to be a decent person? And certainly, so much of the Buddhist path, especially in these early teachings, and especially in this chapter of the Dhammapada, these chapters, is about being able to know what afflictive emotion is and know its nature so that you can reject it, not attach to it. So judgment is really important. Of course, we have to know how to use it wisely and not turn it into a kind of reverse form of self-cherishing, which I think is what we mean when we say, I'm very judgmental of myself. But judgment itself is, you can't get rid of it. You can't, it's a futile effort. So here's the opening verse or two. One is not just who judges a case hastily. A wise person considers both what is and isn't right. Guiding others without force, impartially and in accord with the Dharma, one is called a guardian of the Dharma, intelligent and just. So it looks like the opening verse is actually about a judge. A judge who might judge quickly. And you judge quickly, right? If you're already know, you know, what you want to, the verdict you want to reach. In other words, you're partial. So then you can be very quick to judge. That is, in fact, not a judge at all. There's no real judgment there. If you're too quick to judge because you're already partial, you're not really judging. Then the verse says something that I think is very subtle and important. So a bad judge automatically knows who's guilty and who's not guilty and doesn't take much time to decide. A bad judge chooses the innocent and rejects the guilty right away. But the true judge, the good judge, pays equal attention to both sides, the good as well as the bad. And in that sense, is deliberate and impartial. In other words, she doesn't just reject the bad out of hand. She studies it. She knows it thoroughly. And in this way, she can choose the good. So that's a kind of interesting and surprising point. And that's the way of the Buddha, I think. Not rejecting the bad out of hand, pushing it away as if it were, you know, somehow poison, but understanding it, appreciating it. And that's how the Buddha can guide people without force. In other words, with compassion, no coercion, because the Buddha doesn't condemn or push away what's bad and reject it, simply reject it. He chooses the good, but understands the bad and accepts the bad. Because he knows that if there is going to be good, there's also going to be bad. Because the bad depends on the good and the good depends on the bad. And so he has a lot of spaciousness in his way of guiding people and a lot of compassion. I think that's what's being said in these verses. One is not wise only because one speaks a lot. One who is peaceful, without hate, and fearless is said to be wise. One does not uphold the Dharma only because one speaks a lot. Having heard even a little, if one perceives the Dharma with one's own body and is never negligent of the Dharma, then one is indeed an upholder of the Dharma. And we have that saying, you know, a person talks the talk but doesn't walk the walk. You know, here it's the saying, no, talking the talk doesn't mean much. It's walking the walk that counts. So even if you don't know a lot about the Dharma and are not going to be able to give lengthy expositions about this and that, but the Dharma has really touched your body. You perceive the body, you perceive the Dharma with your whole body. I think the text actually says, you see the Dharma. You see the Dharma, not with your eye or with your mind, but with your whole body. Then you are truly a sage, regardless of how much you can recite or speak learnedly about the teachings. And this is something that's really, really important in our Zen tradition, especially in Soto Zen, where we don't think that teaching the Dharma is giving talks and, telling people what to do. We think that teaching the Dharma is living the Dharma and being willing to live with others as you live the Dharma. And that's the way you teach them, by your conduct. That's what I think that verse is telling us. Gray hair does not make one an elder. Someone ripe only in years is called an old fool. It's through truth, dharma, harmlessness, restraint, and self-control that the wise one, purged of impurities, is called an elder. And that's what we call the teachers in our communities. We don't really call them teachers per se, because that's not the point. They're elders of the community. They're mature in practice. They're examples. So to be an elder doesn't mean you're old. To be an elder means that you have stability and devotion and faith, and you have wisdom. And you could be quite old and not have that, or you could be quite young and have that. And there are lots of old people who we wouldn't call elders. Not through talk alone or by good looks does someone envious, stingy, and treacherous become a person of good character. But with these cut off, uprooted, and destroyed, a person wise and purged of faults is called of good character. So naturally, everybody is attracted to a good-looking person who's a convincing talker. And a person like that is definitely going to go far in life. We've seen that. But good character is something else altogether. And here the phrase is used, uprooted, cut off, and destroyed, which maybe made you feel a little funny when you heard that. It seems a little violent and extreme. But in the Buddhist path, when a person truly understands how things are, in other words, when they've seen through ignorance, they are said to have cut off the entanglements that cause impurity or affliction. That's the kind of language used, cut through the entanglements. And therefore, that person won't intentionally do harm, because the tendency to do so, the temptation to do so, has been severed. Next verses. Not by means of a shaven head does someone dishonest and undisciplined become a renunciant. How could someone filled with longing and greed be a renunciant? Someone who has pacified evil, small and great, in every way, is, for that reason, called a renunciate. One is not a mendicant just because one begs from others, nor does one become a mendicant by taking on domestic ways. But whoever sets aside both merit and evil, lives the chaste life, and goes through the world deliberately, is called a mendicant. Here again, we see that these verses are telling us that our practice is not about what we do on the outside, it's about our inner state, not how we look or how we appear to others. It's how we really are as people. And it's not about our grabbing hold of the good and rejecting the bad, it's about our paying attention in our living all the time. Just the way that gray hair doesn't make you an elder, being an attractive speaker and wearing robes doesn't make you a sage. Being a monastic doesn't make you a true renunciant. I'm sure many of you have been to Buddhist countries where, for many centuries, there's been a celibate monastic community. And in those countries, people who wear the Buddha's robe are automatically respected, given donations, and treated with great deference. When I was in India a long time ago, I was wearing my robes all the time in India. And once I went to a huge outdoor week-long teaching of the Dalai Lama, and people kept giving me money and treating me like a king, with great deference. And I kept saying, "No, no, 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 I'm not a special person. I'm not a monastic like all these noble people, who are deserving of your respect. But I'm just a regular person, But I couldn't get them to stop doing it. I had all this money. At the end of the teaching, I had to give it away to other people. It was very embarrassing. But they do that, they see somebody in the robe and they go, "Oh, very special." And in our teaching, in Dogen's way of practice, there is a lot of lore about the importance of the robe, the outer manifestation. We say it's the tat we say, it's the Tathagata's teaching, this robe. It's sacred and it's worthy of respect. So we sew the robe, we wear the robe, the rakasu and the okesa. We receive them in solemn ceremonies, and we honor everybody who wears them. And I think all of that is a good thing. And yet, these verses are telling us, no, wearing the robe is not a reason to be prideful or an excuse to goof off. I'm working really hard in my practice. Now that I have the robe, I can relax, forget about it. It's the opposite. The robe makes us more humble and encourages us by wearing it to conduct ourselves in a way that is worthy of it. We become very embarrassed and ashamed when we are conducting ourselves in a way that's not worthy of that robe. And of course, you don't have to wear the robe to have that attitude. It's the same. To practice the Buddha way is to take care of our character and our conduct, to love and support all beings, as we always chant. Not by silence does an ignorant fool become a sage. The wise person, who, as if holding a set of scales, selects what's good and avoids what's evil, is for that reason a sage. Whoever can weigh these two sides of the world is for that reason called a sage. So we're sort of back to the scales of justice and the two sides where we started. And the verse seems to reference an ancient Indian custom of spiritual people sometimes taking a vow of silence, for the rest of their lives or for some period of time. I remember a long time ago, in the age of so many gurus, maybe there's still as many gurus as ever, but it seemed like there were more 40, 50 years ago than there are now. I remember there was one very popular Indian guru who had taken a vow of silence. And so people who studied with him, he never said anything, ever. And his silence was a form of, I should take that vow, that'd be good for me. Now that I think about it. Anyway, his silence was a form of kind of spiritual charisma. And so when I think the Buddha references it here, I think he sort of means it to stand for all the different ways that a person could have, spiritual powers, magical powers, all sorts of asceticisms, which do impress us and amaze us when people do that. It's like, it's wow, they can do that. It is impressive. The Buddha is saying here that, yes, there's all of that, but that's not what I'm after. That's not what I'm doing. He's saying, my path is only about, and here again he returns to the idea of the opening verse, it's only about understanding clearly and compassionately both what is good and what is not good, and choosing the good. My path, he's saying, is the path of conduct and character. It's the path of seeing the world as it really is and living in that world freely. Not by harming living beings is one a noble one, but by being harmless to all living beings is one called a noble one. And the hallmark of the path of the Buddha is harmlessness, supporting life, never denigrating or diminishing life. That's the path of conduct that the Buddha really, really cares about. So now we're at the last verse, which is a kind of cautionary verse. And it amounts to, when you think about it, the theme that we were talking about months and months ago for quite a while. And I'm thinking of it now because I just got today heard from my editor at Shambhala that my new book called Continuous Practice, which was that theme we were talking about, is needs to be proofed and corrected and all that. So this last verse, I think, references continuous practice. It's saying that the path of the Buddha, even at its best, is not about accumulating all the good stuff, virtue, strong meditation, strong learning, happiness, true renunciation. It's not really about accomplishing and accumulating all those good inner qualities. It's about ongoing practice, continuing to practice. Continuous practice, as we understand it from Dogen, is without end. It's round and round and round in a circle. As human beings, we will always be striving to, as the verse says, completely let go of all outflows, all asravas, or as Gill translates, all toxins, all impurities, constantly working on our practice. And as long as we're alive, there'll always be more to do. So the verse says, not with virtue or religious practice, great learning, attaining samadhi, dwelling alone, or thinking, I touch the happiness of renunciation unknown by ordinary people. Should you, monk, rest assured without having destroyed the toxins, the asravas. So you should keep on practicing on and on and on. So, thank you for listening. It's time for our groups. But before we do that, I'll just give you some homework assignment. There was none the last time, but this time I have some homework assignment. If this is maybe a little hard to grasp, but see what we can do. It's from the opening lines of The Judge or The Just. It says that the Buddha guides without force. And all that we said about that, how does the Buddha do that? By not rejecting what's bad. So the homework is to look at your own mind and your own interactions with others, to study what it would mean to guide without force, with impartiality, guide yourself without force, and guide others without force. What would that mean to you in the light of this verse? So if you can understand that, if that makes sense to you, see what you can do about that, and we'll try to remember next time to see what you found out. The other thing I want to say before the groups is that we will be sitting this Saturday at Green Gulch. I hope, usually by this time, there's no space left, but maybe there is. If you haven't registered, you can try to register, but we'll see you on Saturday if you can come.
I think it's full.
Yeah, well, sorry about that. Yeah, I think we try to organize it so that we let you know before other people know, so you have a chance to sign up. So I hope there's no one who wanted to go in the Sangha who can't go. Anyway, for discussion groups, and we'll get into groups of three in a moment. 3 minutes to each person. So, what's your take on this theme of purity and impurity as described in chapter 18? Do these ideas or concepts help you in your own practice? Do you recognize them? Are they not helpful ideas? How did you feel about the discussion of purity or impurity in this chapter? What struck you? So, let's talk about that in groups of three. And as always, this is not about what the Buddha says. This is about what you can make use of in what the Buddha says. So that what's more important is your experience and your practice than your explaining what you think of the Buddhist teaching. It shouldn't be an external question. It should be something for your own life. So with that in mind, each person has 3 minutes each. The group can time itself, and we'll see you in about maybe 12 minutes or so.